Okay, this is the second of two lectures on the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. What is our goal in the analysis of this particular event? We're concerned with these big issues. The big issue of, you know, war and peace. What makes for a stable international system? And related to that, these issues of policy. Is there anything that you could say about the sort of policy that makes for a more peaceful world, makes for a more stable international order? Okay. And the basic, yes? Okay, maybe I should just try and figure out how to get this thing to work a little bit. Oh, I see, okay. Okay, is this any better? A little bit. I'll turn it up to the max. Okay. It's like if you see this thing, there are like green lights, and then there's a yellow light, and now we're on the red light, which is the very top. Okay. I'll try. Let's see. Oops. Okay. All right. It's a little more detailed, the outline today, than usual, because the whole analysis is going to have a very clear structure. I wanted to lay it out for you, but let me begin by just kind of outlining the premise that lies at the heart of the analysis in the lecture today. And that's the idea that these general notions of what makes for a stable international order, these broad, abstract concepts about how you make for a more peaceful world, about what makes for war, what makes for a stable international system, what makes for good foreign policy, all those kind of general things, the way to get a handle on those questions is by bringing them down to earth, by translating these general ideas into a set of expectations or a set of interpretations about particular historical episodes. Because the more concrete something is, the more studyable it is. Studyable in terms of the hard empirical evidence. You know, when you're talking about these general things, how do you get a handle on them? It's like trying to grab hold of a cloud. They're so general, so abstract. You have to have some way of bringing them down to earth. And as it turns out, these general notions do kind of translate into interpretations about particular historical episodes, right? Here you have this peace of 1919. Like I said last time, the only great peace settlement in the modern history of great power politics to be dictated by the Western democracies and by them alone. That was not the case in 1815. It was not the case in 1945. Lesser settlements, don't fit into that category at all. But this peace of 1919 was extremely unstable, right? You know, like I said, just a decade later, before Hitler, before even the Depression, by the late 1920s, we'll be seeing this. You know, the whole thing is in a total shambles. Everything is totally up in the air. It was clear, even in the 1920s, that the peace had failed. How do you explain that? Given that this was an order that was crafted by the three major democratic powers, Great Britain, France, and the United States, it's like, what does that tell us? So this general notion about how to conduct foreign policy, what makes for war, that all those ideas, that cluster of ideas,
that we associate with Wilsonianism translates into a particular interpretation of the origins of the world. At least there's an affinity between Wilsonianism, the general approach to foreign policy, general understanding of how international politics works, and a particular interpretation of what happened at Paris in 1919, why the peace that was imposed on Germany in 1919 was so unsuccessful. Right? And then the great competitor of Wilsonianism, this liberal approach to peacemaking, the realist approach, the approach that you see to a very large extent, laid out by George Kennan in that article on American intervention in the First World War that you read, also kind of translates into a very different approach. You know, what is the first approach? These Wilsonian ideas. This Wilsonianism basically is this notion that international conflict has to be understood in moral terms. You know, left to themselves, most people just want to be left at peace. And so the natural order of things is peaceful. So if you do have war, that has to be due to kind of various pathologies, perverse human will, the kinds of policies you associate with non-democratic political orders, this militarism and imperialism and a refusal to pursue a policy based on moral principle. Right? That was the problem in the past, according to the Wilsonians, according to this liberal approach. Why did you have the First World War? It's because of all this balance of power stuff. It's because people were not pursuing policy based on a respect for fundamental human rights, for moral principle, for principles of justice, for concern with right and wrong. Instead, they were concerned with power, and instead of looking toward just settlements, they were thinking in terms of just the adjustments of interest and compromise and all those kinds of things that you associate with what was at that time called the old diplomacy, the diplomacy of arms and alliances, the diplomacy that you had in Europe before 1914, the sort of structure, the argument ran, that had led to the war, that was the cause of the war. So if you want a peaceful world, you have to go beyond that. You have to take a fundamentally different approach to peacemaking. And what is that fundamentally different approach? Approach based on moral principles, on respect for fundamental rights, on a concern with right and wrong, not concern with power, the balance of power. That was the problem. The solution is to make sure that international arrangements are just, that they conform to your notion of what's just, that are based on principles of justice, that they're based on moral principles like the principle of self-determination, like the extension of of democratic political systems, the extension of freedom throughout the world. Right? If you have that sort of approach, you can craft a peace that's going to work. And then to make sure that it works, instead of the balance of power, you pool everyone's power to kind of support that established order. Instead of a balance of power, Wilson spoke of a community of power. That was the whole idea of the League of Nations, of international organization. Right? The heart of the League of Nations was Article 10 of what was called the Covenant of the League of Nations. That's like the Constitution of the League of Nations. And the Covenant of the League of Nations, Article 10, said, I'll just read a few, that the members of the League undertake to respect and preserve, as against external aggression, the territorial integrity and existing political independence of all members of the League. Any member of the League is threatened. Every other member of the League is supposed to come to the aid of that country. That's collective security. That's going to underpin this international order. This is the Wilson conception. And so, if you buy into that conception, as a lot of people do, and that Wilsonian strand, that liberal strand, is a fundamental element of American political culture to this very day, if you buy into that, how do you understand the failure of the peace? Because the failure of the peace of 1919 was extremely dramatic. How do you understand it? Well, one typical line of argument taken by people who look at things in those terms is that you can't blame it on Wilson. Obviously, you can't blame it on Wilson or on Wilsonianism, because by assumption, your basic premise, your basic assumption is that Wilsonianism is a recipe for a good international order, stable, peaceful international order. So if the peace failed, it couldn't be Wilson's fault. It couldn't be because he applied these principles. It must be because he was frustrated. He was blocked. He was obstructed in terms of his ability to achieve what he wanted, to base a peace on those principles. Obstructed by the European great powers, Great Britain, but especially France, who never really were convinced that Wilsonianism was the way to go. And obstructed also at home by his compatriots who were unwilling to accept the obligations that Article 10 of the Lee Covenant, the collective security provision, seemed to be calling for. Right? You can't blame Wilson. He wanted America to play the role of a moral leader of the world. He wanted the peace to be based on moral principles, on principles of justice and fairness and so on. And he was frustrated in that ambition. That explains why the Treaty of Versailles was so bad. Instead of a Wilsonian peace that looked toward the reconciliation of peoples on the basis of a common shared set of moral principles, instead of a Wilsonian peace, you have a vindictive peace, a Carthaginian peace, a peace that was kind of based on these earlier conceptions of how policy should be conducted, a peace championed by the French, a peace based on power political considerations, a desire to keep German power down in order to keep Germany from threatening France. They refused to accept the vision of the new world that Wilson had laid out. Now that's a very, very common view in American political culture. On the other hand, there were all along some people who said, no, it's not quite so simple. You know, Wilsonianism was not necessarily the solution. It was part of the problem. And you saw that in that Kennan article. There was another way you could go. You didn't have to think in these moral terms. In international politics, it's a mistake to take a moralistic approach. Instead, why is it a mistake? Because it leads you to fight wars as crusades, to either not go into war at all or not even prepare for war because the moral issues aren't clear-cut. But once you go in, it's because the moral issues are clear-cut. It becomes a struggle of good versus evil. You can't compromise with evil. You wouldn't want to negotiate a peace. Evil has to be crushed. You have to fight the war as a crusade and so on. And as soon as you win, then you pull out because you've slayed the dragon and you don't have to worry about the future because this is a way of thinking that's focused on the past rather than on creating a stable world in the future. To create a stable world in the future, from this point of view, you need an effective balance of power. You need an effective, an equilibrium of power so that everyone is kind of held back from pursuing policies that threaten international stability. Right? That's the kind of canon view. And that also translates into a certain set of expectations about the peace. Suggests that, well, maybe Wilson wasn't quite as guiltless as we think. Maybe certain key aspects of the Versailles peace are to be understood in terms of the basic Wilson philosophy. And so did we propose to kind of get at this issue? You know, you see these basic approaches to foreign policy and international politics, how they translate into different interpretations of this particular historical episode, peacemaking in Paris in 1919. And then you examine those interpretations in the light of the evidence. But on two levels. One level is the level of the basic thinking about how the peace should take shape. And then the other level is the level of what do they do on concrete issues, specific issues, in the peace negotiations. And so last time we focused on this general stuff. And what was the point there? Wilsonianism, what's the heart of the Wilsonian philosophy? Germany had committed a crime. If you believe in justice, you can't allow these criminals to get off scot-free. Justice means you punish the criminal nation. If you believe in the rule of law, how could you allow the lawbreaker to get off scot-free? The whole idea was justice, but that implied a punitive peace. Not forever. The plan wasn't to kind of keep the Germans down forever. The hope was that Germany would be under a shadow, under a cloud for a generation, 20 years or so, 30 years maybe. During that period, the Germans would recognize that they had committed this crime and would make penance for it. They would accept the fact that they had committed a crime, and therefore this unequal treatment was natural. Because the essence of the Versailles Peace is an important point. The essence of Versailles Peace was that Germany was not treated as an equal. Germany was to be kept down. Germany was not to have the same political rights as the victor powers, particularly in terms of her ability to build up her power. Whereas the Western powers could build up their military power to whatever level they wanted, Germany would not have that right. Germany's power was to be limited by the disarming provisions, by the fact she wasn't allowed to fortify her Western border, a variety of other things. Okay? So what justified that? The Wilson notion Germany had caused the war. After the Germans had done this, after they had accepted their responsibility and make amends for what they had done, then they would be welcomed back into the community of civilized nations. After a generation. Wilson spoke of a generation of thoughtfulness. This was not the sort of policy that Wilson had called for before the United States entered the war. It's very important that you remember that the peace without victory speech was made 2 months before the United States entered the war. Peace without victory, negotiated peace, peace among equals and so on, peace of reconciliation. Yes, that was American policy while America was a neutral. That was a recipe for settling the war between these two sets of belligerents, neither of whom America approved of entirely. But as soon as the United States entered the war, it was as though this great switch were thrown. No more talk of peace without victory, compromise peace, negotiated peace. In fact, Wilson rakes over the coals anyone who talks along those lines. They're practically traitors. Certainly not patriotic to talk about the need for compromise with Germany. How can you compromise with evil? And what's the proof that they're evil? Well, the fact that we're at war with them, because we wouldn't go to war with them if they weren't evil. And that's why I wanted you to read those wartime addresses, because you could see how harsh this philosophy was. You know, that Germany had to be crushed. Her whole political system had to be destroyed. Yes. Well, just by calling for it, not by arming or threatening intervention on one side or the other in any serious way if they didn't achieve the sort of weren't willing to comply with the sort of arrangements the United States thought was proper. You give a speech like the Peace Without Victory speech, and you hope everyone is going to say, yeah, that makes sense, we should do that. But it's not like you say to the Germans, look, this is the kind of peace we think you guys should agree to. You could keep your political institutions, but you'd have to kind of evacuate areas that you had conquered and so on. And if you agree to that, we'll come into the war on your side, or we certainly won't go into the war on the side of the Allies. But if you don't agree to that, we'll come into the war on the other side. You know, or similarly, you know, taking the same line with the Allies. You know, you should lower your sights and agree to a compromise peace with Germany, because if you don't do that, we're not going to tolerate your blockade of Germany, the way you stop American ships on the high seas and so on and prevent us from doing this. You know, we'll in effect lean against you if you don't do what we want. But they don't think in these terms because they don't think of military power as a legitimate and normal instrument of foreign policy. There's no real preparedness for intervention. When it comes, they have to pretty much build up an army from scratch, which explains why the Germans had this window of opportunity. They knew that it would take the United States a long time to make its power effective in Europe, and during that period, they thought their submarine campaign could knock the British out of the war. Right? If the Americans had been ready to intervene on a moment's notice, then the Germans wouldn't have had that window. They couldn't have done this sort of thing. But it's not just Wilson. There's something about American political culture that shrinks from the use of power in that way. It doesn't view power as a legitimate element in American foreign policy. I mean, it's like, you know, we'll talk about this a bit more in the to the end of the class, because, you know, you look at American policy in the Middle East, it's the same sort of thing. It's not like threatening either side or giving assurances to both sides or whatever, or threatening both sides if they don't do what the United States wants. You know, you wash your hands of them. It's like, oh, well, we think it's very bad for Israel to continue with the settlements, but if they continue, we are not going to put any pressure on them because we don't think that the use of pressure is a legitimate instrument of international politics. These kinds of notions run very deep in American political culture, and you see them at play in with Wilson in 1917 to 1919, okay? So we looked at this, and we see this dramatic change that takes place in the whole American approach to peacemaking after the U.S. comes into the war. Now it's Germany has to be crushed. And in terms of the fundamental approach he takes at Versailles, it has to be based on principles of justice. Germany had committed a crime. Germany should be punished for the crime. And he uses words like that, crime, punishment, and so on. Okay, all this stuff has just been filtered out of people's historical consciousness. Why? Because people's understanding of the past is very much a function of what they want to believe politically. And then there are the basic approaches of the other powers. But Wilson's main antagonist in the sense in this regard is the French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau. He's very skeptical of these Wilsonian notions. You know, justice? What do you mean justice? You know, it's like, you know, the world is not shaped by heavenly decree. You know, the sorts of arrangements you see around you are the product of force. What each country now has is the result of centuries of armed struggle, violence. Who's to say what's right and wrong in such circumstances? These issues are far more problematic than that. You think, you know, you just make a peace based on your conception of justice. You think the Germans are going to accept that? You know, dream again. It doesn't work that way. You have to worry about power realities. You know, you have to worry about security against the resurgent Germany. If you give Germany the same political rights as everyone else, then what's to balance German power? What's to keep the Germans in check? So you have to worry about these things. But the important thing to note about the French policy was that, in a sense, it wasn't fundamentally antagonistic to Wilson, because the French notion was to create a stable international order. The key thing was to make sure that Germany was in check, and you could do that in a number of ways, but the preferred way, the heart of French policy, the core of what they wanted to do, was to maintain the alliance of the three Western powers that had come into being in the last year of the war. Okay? They wanted a continuing post-war alliance with Britain and the United States. Okay? And Clemenceau said, when he, unlike Wilson and Lloyd George, he refused to lay out a peace program. And he tells the Chamber of Deputies in France why. He says, because I'm going to have to make sacrifices. My goal is to maintain the wartime alliance. To achieve that, I'm going to have to reach compromises with our two main allies. And therefore, I'm not going to tie my hands by telling you what my policy is. I want to keep a free hand because the maintenance of the alliance is by far the most important goal. Right? But the problem is that you have this Wilsonian conception that kind of rules out the notion of a continuing alliance into the post-war period. Right? You don't want to think in terms of military power playing a permanent, normal role in international politics. We had defeated Germany. We had dealt with this threat. Now we could go home and relax. And we'll still be involved in European affairs, but by way of issuing pronouncements from Washington, using our moral authority to tell the Europeans what they should be doing. Right? So this is, and so the French problem is, how do you deal with that kind of situation? And one of the things they try and do is by saying, look, if you're unwilling to give us what we really need, in other words, the maintenance of the Western Bloc is a way of kind of keeping Germany in line. If you're unwilling to maintain the coalition of the three Western powers, then you're forcing us to opt for a much harsher strategy vis-a-vis Germany. We're sure you don't want that, so maybe you should reconsider. Maybe you should give us something more in the way of guarantee. So they're considering a harsher policy as an alternative, not their preference, largely as an instrument of pressure. But they're also considering a softer policy of we've been abandoned, we've been betrayed by our Anglo-Saxon allies. In such circumstances, we really should try and mend fences with the Germans and see if we can reach some sort of accommodation with them. So that, because antagonism is always a source of weakness in international politics. If France and Germany quarrel, then that simply puts the British and the Americans in the driver's seat. You don't want that, so therefore maybe you could test the waters and see if there's any possibility of an Anglo-French rapprochement. And so there are these overtures, and those overtures are built on that same realist approach to international politics. Realism being the notion that moral considerations should take a backseat to considerations related to power realities. Right? Okay. So we looked at stuff at that general level, and when you look at the general level, you see right away there are certain flaws with the interpretation that supports the idea that Wilsonianism is the way to go. Wilsonianism is the right approach to foreign policy. But you might say, well, that's just abstractions. Those are just words. What really counts is what they're doing on these nuts and bolts issues. People could take this whole idea that the peace has to be based on principles of justice and that Germany should be punished for her crimes. But if in reality the Wilson policy was a lot more moderate than the policy of the Europeans in general, the French in particular, then you can't take that line. You have to focus on what they were actually doing on the nuts and bolts issues. So today I want to just go through the nuts and bolts issues and ask two questions. One is, when you look at the negotiations, do you see this struggle between basically Americans who want a moderate peace, peace of reconciliation, soft peace toward Germany, and the Europeans, especially the French, who are the champions of a harsh peace vis-a-vis Germany? And then we're going to look at the outcome of the negotiations, the final terms that were drafted into the Treaty of Versailles. And we're going to ask, does this represent the defeat of Wilson, that he was frustrated, obstructed by the Europeans? Or does it represent an essentially Wilsonian peace? In other words, is the Treaty of Versailles in line with Wilson's basic philosophy or not? And so we'll break it down into first the territorial issues and then the non-territorial issues. And the territorial issues, we're going to begin with Germany's western border and then move to Germany's eastern border. Okay? Germany's western border, first of all. Alsace-Lorraine was given back to France. No problem there. That was explicitly called for in Wilson's 14 points. You know, based on the principle of self-determination and so on. But the French seemed to want more than that. They wanted, at the peace conference, and again, for bargaining purposes, instrumental purposes, they asked, I think in large measure, they asked for the right to occupy the Rhineland on a permanent basis. A right they were asking for, not for themselves, but they wanted all three Western powers to garrison that area. And this was resisted by Wilson, even more by Lord George, who said he didn't want to create another Alsace-Lorraine to poison the peace of Europe. Any measure of special status in the Rhineland, autonomy for the Rhineland, cutting it off any way from the heart of Germany, was a source of difficulty. So they reached a compromise, and the compromise was that the Rhineland would be demilitarized. The Germans, in other words, the Germans wouldn't be allowed to fortify it, and thus they would be vulnerable to French military pressure. And this was the whole left bank of the Rhine. This whole area here to the left of this blue line, plus a little strip of territory on the right bank of the Rhine, so that the Rhine River itself would not serve as a protective barrier for Germany. And the compromise was that this would be for as long as Germany complied with the treaty and lived up to the terms of the treaty, this would be temporary. The first zone in the Rhineland, the northern zone, would be evacuated after 5 years, the middle zone after 10, and the southern zone after 15 years. After 15 years, the Allies would be out, but the Rhineland would remain demilitarized. Wilson doesn't have any problem with this. No fundamental problem. You know, it's in line with this generation of thought from this notion. The whole idea that the Germans shouldn't fortify the Rhine. Well, fortifications are preparation for war. War is bad. Military preparations are bad. You know, you can go along with the final settlement that was reached. In line with this notion of, quote, a generation of thoughtfulness. Okay? Eastern territorial issues. First, Austria. The Habsburg monarchy fell apart at the end of the war. Not because Wilson had championed political independence for the countries within the Habsburg monarchy, for the Czechs and the Southern Slavs and so on. 14 points and related addresses had only called for autonomy for those areas. But with the collapse of the Austrian monarchy, those countries proclaimed their independence. And that left this problem, the rump Austrian state, the state inhabited by ethnic Germans, the state that was left after all the other areas had fallen away. This state had big problems, a huge metropolis, for this big empire, Vienna, stuck in this very small, scarcely industrialized part of Europe. It was not quite viable economically. And so the Austrians, in Rump Austria, wanted to become part of Germany. And this the Allies ruled out, because Germany was already, in terms of her industrial potential and size of her population, much stronger than France, which is the only other major power on the continent. You're going to make Germany stronger still? You know, if the Germans have caused the war, are you going to end the war by strengthening Germany's position in one fundamental way? No, no fundamental problem with the principle of self-determination telling the Austrians, no, you can't, you have to remain independent. You can't become part of Germany. The big issues on the Eastern Front had to do with Poland. 14 points called for the resurrection of a Polish state. Poland had not existed as an independent state since the late 18th century, when it was divided between its three big neighbors, Prussia, Austria, and Russia. And now the notion was, we're going to reconstruct an independent Polish state. Well, that's in line with Wilson's principles, right? And in fact, you know, it was called for in the 14 points. You know, Wilson's great wartime program. And the French also supported the Poles. But the British were much cooler. So instead of a conflict between America and France, with Britain in between, you had a conflict between America and France on the one hand, and then British on the British on the other. Why were they cool on the Poles? Because they didn't consider the Poles quite civilized enough. They thought the Poles would mistreat their minorities, and in particular their German minority, and this would create all kinds of problems. But there's a problem here. In order to create a viable Polish state, that state needs access to the sea, or at least it was thought in those days. And that means that the whole course of the Vistula River, which is the kind of lifeline of Poland, should be in Polish hands. And again, this was the basic Wilson policy, to support Poland getting those territories, right? Making sure that Poland was viable. Self-determination implied a viable state. The problem here, though, is that the lower course of the Vistula River ran through areas that were inhabited either by ethnic Germans or by people who, although ultimately of Polish ethnicity, had come over the years to think of themselves as German. So what are you going to do about this whole area? This area here. This little stretch to the east, that's called East Prussia. That remains part of Germany, but the area between East Prussia and Germany proper, this is called the Polish Corridor. Right? And it was given to Poland, even though a lot of the people who lived there, in fact the majority, if you had asked them in a plebiscite, would have voted for union with Germany. This is a problem for the British, but not a problem for the Americans and not a problem for the French. They took the pro-Polish line. And the same thing is true of the other big area having to do with the Polish-German border, which is Upper Silesia. And that's this area down here. Okay? Upper Silesia is the second most important area in terms of heavy industry. In Germany, it was before the war, right after the Ruhr Basin in the west. This is a lot of coal, steel is produced in Upper Silesia. And Upper Silesia had a mixed population, maybe two-thirds German, one-third Polish. And the original plan, supported by the Americans and the French and opposed by the British, was to give Upper Silesia to Poland in order for Poland to be economically viable, big economic asset. And Lloyd George objected, British Prime Minister objected. Finally, they agreed that there would be a plebiscite held in 1921. The plebiscite, on the basis of the plebiscite, the League would divide Upper Silesia up between Germany and Poland, which is what happened. So the final settlement there in Upper Silesia, certainly not inconsistent with what Wilson wanted, not harsher to Germany than what Wilson wanted, and in line with the basic principle of self-determination. So territorial provisions of the post-war settlement were basically in line with the Wilson philosophy. You just compare the map of 1919 with the map of 1914. You have all these new states in Eastern Europe that had arisen after the collapse of the three Eastern empires. Not just Germany and Austria, but the Russian Empire as well had collapsed. Right? That was as close as you got until relatively recent years to Europe based on the principle of self-determination. In territorial terms, this was scarcely inconsistent with the fundamental Wilson philosophy. Even the Rhineland provisions, in line with the basic Wilson philosophy, you gotta keep the Germans down for a number of years until they had worked their way back into the community of civilized nations. But what about the non-territorial provisions? Okay, and we'll just go through them. The Treaty of Versailles called for the trial of the war criminals, and it also had a provision, which is the basis for the reparation clauses, saying that Germany was primarily responsible for the war. Right? It's the famous Article 231 of the Treaty of Versailles. No objection on Wilson's part. Article 231 simply reflected what he and most other people in those days took for granted. Yeah, the war was caused by Germany. Germany was the criminal power. And in terms of the way the war was fought, Germans had committed what were called in those days atrocities. From our point of view, they seemed very mild. But Germans who had perpetrated these atrocities, they would be put on trial. The German leadership that was supposedly responsible for the war, the Kaiser and so on, they would also be put on trial. No real objection on Wilson's part, because that's in line with his basic notion. You believe in the rule of law, of course you should punish lawbreakers. How can anyone dispute that? And yet these provisions, you know, were very grating for the Germans. French were much cooler about all these kinds of things. They didn't think it was a big deal. They went along with the stuff in order to accommodate their allies. Disarmament provisions. Germany was not allowed to have an air force, not allowed to have any navy of any size. Germany's army was to be limited to 100,000 men, long-term conscripts, long-term volunteers. Germany's fortresses were to be raised. As I said, the Rhineland was to be demilitarized, and so on. These provisions, no problem insofar as Wilson was concerned. The French, incidentally, wanted Germany to have a 200,000-man army, not 100,000-man. The army was to be based on conscription rather than on long-term enlistees, because the notion was if you draw the army from the society as a whole, it's likely to be more democratic, less of a state within a state. But the Anglo-Saxon tradition was conscription is bad, it's an affront to individual liberty. And it was the Anglo-Saxon view, especially in this case the British view, that prevailed. You don't see a big conflict here between Wilson and the French, with Wilson saying the Germans should have the same rights in matters of armaments as everyone else. But there was one area where as a result of the negotiations, the treaty made a nod to the Wilsonian view. And it said it introduced the arrangements providing for the disarmament of Germany with some language saying that this was in order to make possible a more general disarmament of the nations. And the Germans argued that in effect that the Allies had committed themselves now. And if they weren't going to disarm also themselves, then the Germans should be free to ignore the provisions, the disarmament provisions in the treaty. Right? So, but disarmament was not out of line with the basic Wilson philosophy, generation of thoughtfulness. Germans had caused the war. You were entitled to take certain measures to make sure that they couldn't do another time what they had done in 1914. League of Nations. This is the basic Wilson concept. embodied in the Treaty of Versailles. The Covenant of the League of Nations was an integral part of the Treaty of Versailles. French had no problem with this, because if you take Article 10 seriously, basically you're freezing the status quo. It's a way of guaranteeing that American power and British power and the power of every other country that's part of the League will be used to keep Germany in line in the event that Germany ever tries to break out. As a matter of fact, the French said you've got to take Article 10 seriously. If you're serious about making sure that the League of Nations is able to act in the event of aggression, in the event that the territorial integrity or whatever of any of its member states is threatened, then the League needs military force. It needs some sort of an army. And they proposed that sort of thing. Again, they were defeated. The Wilsonian conception of the League prevailed. Wilson was against the League of Nations having an army. Why? Because, as he said at the time, I quoted this last time, it's wrong to substitute international militarism for national militarism. Again, this notion that military power doesn't have a legitimate place to play in international politics. Okay? And finally, the reparations. Reparations, everyone thinks reparations. This was the French attempt to really crush Germany. The reparations were impossible. The Germans couldn't possibly pay them and so on. And the reparation provisions marked the kind of defeat of the Wilsonian program. It's not true. The French did, at the beginning of the conference, call for very high reparations as a way of trying to manipulate the Anglo-Saxon powers into providing them with the material support that they wanted. If you don't continue giving us economic aid and accept the principle that we fought the war together, we should bear the burdens of the peace on an equal basis, then this is what we're going to be forced to do. We're going to be forced to have these terrible provisions vis-a-vis Germany. But the Americans didn't want to go that route. They didn't want to be generous toward Europe. The policy of Wilson is not the policy of the United States pursued after World War II with the Marshall Plan and so on. The Americans, as soon as the war was over, you know, that was it in terms of economic aid to the Allies, right? It's like, they should be grateful for what we had done instead of expecting us to do even more. So when the French understood that the plan was failing and that they were not, the Americans were not willing to budge in terms of the arrangements for the reconstruction of the devastated areas and so on, then they kind of abandoned that and stated their real goals, which converged with those of the American experts. $30 billion Germany should pay, you know, over, a, you know, like a 30-year period. So, you know, it was significant proportion of German national income, like 6% or something like that, you know, but not unbearable, especially given that Germany wasn't supposed to have an army. And the war, don't forget, had been fought in northern France. German territory had been spared. But the Americans, although the American experts were willing to reach this understanding with the French, Wilson did not take that view. He sided with the British, who wanted a much higher reparation settlement. The British wanted to include the pensions in the bill. And the American experts said, no, you shouldn't do that, because the same logic that excluded the war costs should also exclude the pensions. And Wilson says, logic, I don't give a damn about logic. I'm going to include the pensions. So just, go on in this at a very great length. But the bottom line for our purposes is, when you look at the terms of the treaty, and you look at the way it was drafted, you don't find moderate Wilson being outmaneuvered by these vindictive Europeans. You find basically Wilson wanting to have a peace that provided for the punishment of Germany, provided for Germany not to be treated as an equal. When you look at the final terms of the peace, it's hard to see how it's not in line with Wilson's basic approach to peacemaking, basic approach to international policy, right? So let me leave it there, and I'm going to pick up this on the stuff next time.